Chapter 13. A Vaccine for COVID. The story of vaccination begins in 1796 with Edward Jenner of Gloucestershire, who administered the first vaccine against smallpox. At that time, many country folk observed that dairymaids generally had beautiful unmarked skin, proof they had never contracted smallpox. The reason, some claimed, was that their exposure to cowpox, said to be a mild bovine variation of smallpox, gave them immunity to the human form of the disease. Some country folk believed the superstition that after a case of cowpox, you could never get smallpox, a belief contradicted by the observations of physicians at the time. Of course, there is a far better explanation for the beautiful skin of milkmaids. Unlike most people of the time, they had daily access to a superb source of nutrition, including a rich source of vitamin C and nature's premier probiotic food. Good nutrition, including good probiotics, protected milkmaids against diseases like smallpox. Good nutrition protects all of us from disease. Of course, preventing bedbugs with good sanitation also plays an important role, but it is unlikely that milkmaids slept in clean beds. If they did get bitten, the superb nutrition of their milk-based diet protected them. On May 14, 1796, Jenner tested his hypothesis by inoculating James Phipps, an 8-year-old boy who was the son of Jenner's gardener. He scraped pus from cowpox blisters on the hands of a milkmaid and scraped the pus into the arm of the child. Jenner excelled at self-promotion, and in 1802, the English government awarded him £10,000 for continued experimentation. Jenner claimed that his vaccine gave perfect immunity for life. Unfortunately, statistics taken from reports of the Registrar General of England indicate that the vaccine was not a success, with deaths from vaccination outnumbering deaths from smallpox up through the early 1900s. In 1831, a smallpox outbreak in Wurttemberg, Germany, claimed the lives of almost 1,000 people who had received a vaccination, and in the same year, 2,000 vaccinated people in Marseille in France developed smallpox. In 1854-1863, following the introduction of compulsory vaccination programs in Europe, smallpox claimed over 33,000 lives, and other epidemics followed, epidemics in which thousands of vaccinated people died. Compulsory vaccination laws in England were repealed in 1907, by that time their failure too obvious to disguise. During one of the worst smallpox epidemics in England, between 1870 and 1872, the city of Leicester took a different approach. They instituted a system of good sanitation and quarantine, with the result that there was only one death from smallpox in Leicester during the epidemic. Louis Pasteur followed in Jenner's footsteps with the development of a vaccine for chicken cholera, which didn't work, and for anthrax, which was forced on many farmers, who reported that their sheep died anyway, and finally, in 1855, for rabies, also called hydrophobia. The premise was that if you could create a less virulent source of disease and inoculate that into a healthy person, the person would develop immunity and not get sick when he encountered the full-blown illness. Even in Pasteur's day, physicians doubted that hydrophobia was a specific disease. Dogs became vicious through starvation and neglect, and neurological disease leading to insanity could happen in the aftermath of any kind of wound, especially a puncture wound. The most likely cause of rabies is a form of tetanus or botulism. Both are associated with Clostridium toxins that the bacteria produce under anaerobic conditions, as in puncture wounds. Doctors in Pasteur's day had excellent results treating dog bites by cauterizing them with carbolic acid. One doctor reported cauterization of about 400 dog bite victims without one developing a case of hydrophobia. But Pasteur believed that he could prevent rabies by vaccinating the victims of dog bites. He created the rabies vaccine by taking saliva, blood, and part of the brain or spinal cord, usually the cerebrospinal fluid, from a suspected animal and injecting it into a living rabbit, then aging and drying the cells from the rabbit's spinal cord so that it could be injected into human beings. His first patient, a badly bitten 9-year-old boy, received the vaccine, after a doctor had cauterized the wound, and recovered. Pasteur proclaimed his success, but others were not so lucky. A Dr. Charles Bell Taylor, writing in a publication called National Review in July 1890, listed many cases in which Pasteur's patients died, whereas the dogs that had bitten them remained healthy. One of these cases was King Alexander of Greece. In his own reports, Pasteur fudged the numbers to make it seem as though he had a high rate of success. In the practice of medicine, Sometimes the dogma about a certain subject becomes so rigid that even when the truth is sitting in plain sight, physicians simply can't see it. Such is the case when it comes to the concept of permanent immunity to infectious disease. Medical students are taught early in their training that our immune systems are organized around the principle that if we get an infectious disease once, we will never get it again. This is supposedly due to the two phases of our immune system working together to create memory of a virus or bacteria that lasts for life. Scientists have worked out the intimate details of this immune memory over the last century in order to provide the theoretical basis for vaccines. The immune theory also derives from the simple observation that nobody gets the typical childhood diseases twice in their lives. Like many ideas in medicine, however, the truth may be far more complicated. Two simple observations cast doubt on the premise of immunity for life. The first is that certain bacterial diseases, such as strep throat, do tend to recur. In fact, there is no immunity for life construct when it comes to bacterial infections. As for viral infections, we can easily observe that most people get numerous colds and flu throughout their lifetimes. Scientists usually explain this by saying these are just different viruses one catches, and just because you are immune to one, doesn't confer immunity to other viruses. We also know and generally accept the fact that a child who gets chickenpox is susceptible later in life to a second manifestation of chickenpox called shingles. Shingles is believed to be caused by the same virus, but with a different symptom picture. Similarly, many people have experienced repeated bouts of cold sores or herpes outbreaks. So, there is no lifelong immunity in these cases. Interestingly, at the time that Pasteur and others were formulating the germ theory of disease, along with its corollary of immunity for life, many scientists and physicians disagreed. One of the dissenters was Professor Alfred Russel Wallace. In his book The Wonderful Century, he had the following to say about smallpox. Very few people suffer from any special accident twice, a shipwreck, or railway or coach accident, or a house on fire, yet one of these accidents does not confer immunity against it happening a second time. The taking it for granted that second attacks of smallpox, or of any other zoonotic disease, are of that degree of rarity as to prove some immunity or protection, indicates the incapacity for dealing with what is a purely statistical question. Wallace describes a study by Dr. Adolf Vogt, professor of hygiene and sanitary statistics at the University of Bern, Switzerland. Vogt compiled data on those who had contracted smallpox and their subsequent susceptibility to further smallpox episodes. He found that those who had one episode of smallpox were actually 63% more likely to suffer from a second episode as compared with those who had never had a case of smallpox. Vogt concluded, "All this justifies our maintaining that the theory of immunity by a previous attack of smallpox, whether the natural disease or the disease produced artificially, must be relegated to the realm of fiction." Wallace went on to prove that people vaccinated against smallpox actually had a much higher death rate from smallpox than did those who were not vaccinated. In particular, Wallace studied the high death rate from smallpox of the heavily vaccinated soldiers in the U.S. military compared with the results obtained from the sanitation methods employed by the town on Leicester in England. Here is what Wallace concluded. "It is thus completely demonstrated that all the statements by which the public has been gulled for so many years as to the almost complete immunity of the revaccinated army and navy are absolutely false. It is all what the Americans call bluff. There is no immunity. They have no protection. When exposed to infection, they do suffer just as much as other populations or even more. In the whole of the 19 years 1878 to 1896 inclusive, unvaccinated Leicester had so few smallpox deaths that the Registrar General presents the average by the decimal 0.01 per thousand population equal to 10 per million, whereas during 1876 to 1889, there was less than one death per annum. Here we have real immunity, real protection, and it is obtained by attending to sanitation and isolation, coupled with the almost total neglect of vaccination. Neither Army nor Navy can show any such results as this. Clearly, protection through vaccination for diseases like smallpox is an ugly superstition that must be discarded. At the same time, we must abandon the concept of lifelong immunity conferred by the activity of our immune system. But what about the observation that children essentially never get measles twice in their lives? In this case, there is so little actual study of this phenomenon that it is difficult to make any firm conclusions. But we must remember that the typical childhood diseases such as measles, mumps, whooping cough, and chicken pox are best understood as processes of normal growth and maturation for the child. If this is the case, there would be no reason for children to go through these processes more than once in their lives. After all, a tadpole transforms into a frog only once, a caterpillar becomes a butterfly only once. Measles is a process of detoxification, transformation, and growth. If thwarted, particularly by an injection that clearly alters our immune responses, then only worse things can happen. This is clearly revealed by the many studies showing that children who go through typical childhood illnesses such as measles have fewer chronic diseases throughout the course of their lives. The body likely makes a chemical or protein that we call an antibody to mark this event. But it is far from clear that antibodies are protective of anything, or that these childhood diseases are contagious. We must have the courage and insight to rethink this whole concept of disease. For the pharmaceutical companies, however, the concept of introducing a small amount of a bacteria, virus, or toxin into the body to create lifelong immunity supports the practice of vaccination, and by the early 20th century, they were having a field day producing vaccines for any disease they could think of. American soldiers made convenient guinea pigs and complained in letters home of receiving a vaccination every week. Many have surmised that the effects of the Spanish flu were exacerbated on military bases by all these vaccinations inflicted on the troops, including a crude bacterial meningitis vaccination experiment. Another factor that resulted in the high death toll among American soldiers was the use of aspirin, often in huge doses, which undoubtedly contributed to the excessive hemorrhaging that carried so many away. The process for creating modern vaccines involves many trade secrets and numerous ingredients. Unknown to the public is ongoing controversy over which process produces the best and safest results, because serious reactions to vaccinations are commonplace. When one understands the basics of how all modern viral vaccines are manufactured, however, it becomes immediately clear not only how fraudulent the whole process is but also how the production of modern viral vaccines helps prove that these viruses can't possibly be causing the diseases for which they are blamed. To produce a modern vaccine, technicians first collect biological fluids from an infected person, usually respiratory secretions or the fluid from skin lesions. This presumably contains millions of copies of the virus, along with an untold number of components from cellular debris. The fluid is then centrifuged to concentrate the virus. The next step is to inoculate this centrifuged fluid onto a variety of tissue cultures, usually tissue derived from monkey kidney cells, aborted human fetal tissue, or chicken eggs. Some companies have proposed using cancer tissue as a culture, due to the fact that cancerous tissue is easier to grow in large amounts, but this practice is still considered too risky. It turns out the viruses that supposedly will kill us all aren't strong enough to infect the tissue cultures. This means in order to help the virus taken from the sick patient lice kill the tissue cells, they have to starve and poison the tissue first. Once the tissue is weak enough, the virus can then infect the cells, inject its genetic material into the cells, and produce millions of copies of itself. That's the theory, anyway. The resultant infected tissue is an unholy mixture of the original snot, now frozen and distributed across the globe to all the various vaccine manufacturing companies as their stock material, the toxins, antibiotics, oxidizing agents, etc., used to weaken the tissue, the debris from the breakdown of the tissue, and the viruses that emerge from this process. There are often some light purification steps added at this point, but never anything even remotely approaching isolation and purification of the viruses. Then finally, some preservatives, usually mercury for multi-dose vials, still used for the flu vaccine, and stabilizers such as polysorbate 80, an emulsifier that breaks down the blood-brain barrier, are added to this final product. This is a live viral vaccine. A dead or attenuated viral vaccine is all of the above steps and then a final heat or chemical sterilization step at the end to kill or at least neuter the virus. Never mind that one can't say viruses are even alive in any meaningful sense of that word. Nevertheless, they are killed, usually with heat, in this step. Then an adjuvant, usually aluminum, is added to the final product to make sure that the person receiving the mixture attempts to eliminate it from the body and so produce antibodies, considered proof of an immune response that will protect against the disease. Another way to make an attenuated or inactive viral vaccine is to start with dead, killed tissue. Then technicians isolate single protein particles from the dead tissue. Sometimes they even produce these particles synthetically. After that, they add adjuvants and preservatives, including aluminum. Aluminum added to the rest of these toxic chemicals is the likely culprit for the creation of the excessive inflammatory reactions that frequently occur with any attenuated viral vaccine, and are one of the central hallmarks of the COVID syndrome. It would certainly be an interesting research project for someone to track the relationship between prior vaccine usage and subsequent development of COVID symptoms in adults and children. The message that Americans get every morning in the newspapers and every evening on the news is that a COVID vaccine will save us. With mandatory vaccines for everyone, we can go back to life as normal, and scientists will have saved the day. The vaccine would be liability-free and rushed to market, making its debut in January 2021. Liability-free means that the consumer has no redress, no matter how bad the injury to himself or his child. No matter how costly the care after the injury, and it means that vaccine manufacturers have absolutely no incentive to make a vaccine that is either safe or effective. Even if a virus is the cause of COVID, manufacturers face a number of obstacles. For one, the virus already has mutated into at least 30 different genetic variants. The variants include 19 never seen before, as well as rare changes that scientists had never imagined could happen. In addition, the challenge of producing so many vaccines in so short a time is daunting. As described in an article published by Children's Health Defense, the solution proposed by pharmaceutical companies is a new type of vaccine that can outsmart nature using next-generation vaccine technologies such as gene transfer and self-assembling nanoparticles, along with invasive new vaccine delivery and record-keeping mechanisms like smartphone-readable quantum dot tattoos, which will require the vast capacity of 5G networks to read and process. To quickly produce a vaccine for the whole world, they will also need to develop new manufacturing techniques that circumvent the slow processes of traditional vaccine production. The new techniques use genetic engineering, recombinant DNA technology, subjected to expression systems, bacteria, yeast, insect cells, mammalian cells, or plants such as tobacco to produce so-called subunit vaccines. The problematic hepatitis B vaccine was the first to employ this entirely new vaccine production approach, and a number of the COVID vaccines currently under development are deploying these techniques. However, subunit vaccines must be bundled with immune potentiating adjuvants, most likely aluminum, that can trigger an inflammatory immune response. Even newer are DNA and messenger RNA, mRNA, vaccines, which are basically a form of gene therapy. Whereas traditional vaccines introduce a vaccine antigen to produce an immune response, which doesn't actually mean that the recipient is immune, nucleic acid vaccines instead send the body instructions to produce the antigen itself. As one researcher explains, the nucleic acids cause the cells to make pieces of the virus, so that the immune system then mounts a response to those pieces of the virus. DNA vaccines are intended to penetrate all the way into a cell's nucleus. According to one biotech scientist, this is an incredibly difficult task given that our nuclei have evolved to prevent any foreign DNA from entering. Maybe nature has a reason for protecting the nucleus from genetic invasion. When some DNA vaccines made it into clinical trials in the late 2000s, they were plagued by suboptimal potency, meaning they didn't work. Scientists then came up with the idea of augmenting vaccine delivery with electroporation, electric shocks applied to the vaccine site, using a smart device to make cell membranes more permeable and force the DNA into the cells. Electroporation remains a key design feature of some COVID vaccine candidates today. A second aspect of DNA vaccines, their gene-altering properties, is also troubling. DNA vaccines, by definition, come with the risk of integration of exogenous DNA into the host genome, which may cause severe mutagenesis and induce new diseases. Framed in more understandable terms, disruption from DNA is like inserting a foreign ingredient in an existing recipe, which can change the resulting dish. The permanent incorporation of synthetic genes into the recipient's DNA essentially produces a genetically modified human being, with unknown long-term effects. Regarding DNA gene therapy, one researcher has stated, genetic integrations using viral gene therapies can have a devastating effect if the integration was placed in the wrong spot in the genome. Discussing DNA vaccines specifically, The Harvard College Global Health Review notes that the DNA vaccines could cause chronic inflammation, because the vaccine continuously stimulates the immune system to produce antibodies. Other concerns include the possible integration of foreign DNA into the body's host genome, resulting in mutations, problems with DNA replication, autoimmune responses and activation of cancer-causing genes. Think children with birth defects and cancer early in life. The mRNA vaccines are particularly suited to speedy development, and have attracted attention as the coronavirus frontrunners. mRNA vaccines can reportedly generate savings of months or years to standardize and ramp up mass production. mRNA vaccines need reach only the cell cytoplasm rather than the nucleus, an apparently simpler technical challenge, although the approach still demands delivery technologies that can ensure stabilization of mRNA under physiological conditions. This involves chemical modifications to stabilize the mRNA, and liquid nanoparticles to package it into an injectable form. Unfortunately for the pharmaceutical companies, mRNA vaccines have displayed an intrinsic inflammatory component that makes it difficult to establish an acceptable risk-benefit profile. mRNA enthusiasts admit that there is, as yet, an inadequate understanding of the inflammation and autoimmune reactions that may result from the vaccine. This raises the specter of a true disaster should regulators grant the manufacturers of COVID mRNA vaccines their wish for a fast-track process to get mRNA vaccines to people sooner. A good example of a rushed vaccine was the dengue vaccine experiment, which actually increased the risks of dengue fever. Dengue fever is a common disease in more than 120 countries and, like coronavirus, has been the target for a vaccine for many years. The development and licensure of Dengivaxia vaccine by Sanofi spanned more than 20 years and cost more than $1.5 billion. But the development of the vaccine turned out to be difficult. Dengue vaccine antibodies often made the infection worse, called disease enhancement in vaccine speak, especially in infants and children. When the vaccine was administered to thousands of children in the Philippines, at least 600 died. The Philippine government has permanently banned the vaccine from the country. Another rushed vaccine, for the swine flu, was a total fiasco. Early in 1976, after several soldiers became severely ill at Fort Dix in New Jersey, supposedly from swine flu, President Gerald Ford announced a plan to rush through a vaccine so that every American could be vaccinated. But manufacturers balked at the specter of liability for vaccine injuries, and one company produced 2 million doses with the wrong strain. Congress passed a law waiving liability, and Ford pushed plans to inoculate 1 million people per day by the fall, even though reports seeped through that the vaccine had caused injuries and was not effective. In mid-October, Ford went on television to show himself receiving an injection from a White House doctor. Meanwhile, the capricious swine flu failed to appear, and in December, following 94 reports of paralysis from the vaccination, the program was terminated, and the danger of swine flu disappeared from the pages of the newspapers. So far, trials for the coronavirus vaccine have not gone well. On May 18, 2020, Moderna Inc., co-owned by the National Institutes of Health, headquartered in Cambridge, Massachusetts, announced that it had obtained positive interim clinical data from a Phase 1 clinical trial for an mRNA COVID vaccine. Moderna stock soared, and their top executives sold off over $100 million worth of shares. However, four of the 45 participants suffered serious reactions. The three subjects who received the highest doses all experienced grade 3 systemic symptoms, which can mean blistering open ulcers, wet peeling, or serious rash over large areas of the body. The press release did not mention the results of other trials. One volunteer, Ian Hayden, age 29, stated that the vaccine left him the sickest he's ever been. He was rushed to urgent care, where he almost fainted. But Hayden is still cautiously optimistic about a vaccine. The New York Times reported positive results from a vaccine in development by the University of Oxford. Monkeys given an experimental vaccine from the University of Oxford appear to have resisted the novel coronavirus. Six rhesus macaques given HAdOx1-nCoV-19 in Montana did not fall ill despite heavy exposure, was the headline. But they did fall ill. In fact, all the vaccinated macaques sickened after exposure to COVID, suggesting the treatment, which has already received in the region of £90 million in government investment, may not halt the spread of the deadly disease. an experimental vaccine for COVID that uses human fetal cell lines, in development by CanSino Biologics, Inc. of Tianjin, China, also had poor results. In a clinical trial involving 108 volunteers, ranging in age from 45 to 60 years old, 81% suffered at least one adverse reaction within 7 days after vaccination. Adverse effects included fever, fatigue, headache, and muscle pain, some of it severe. Following these disappointing results, the FDA relaxed the rules. On June 30, the agency announced that any COVID vaccine would have to prevent disease, or decrease its severity, in only 50% of the people who receive it. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, AGOC, has suggested testing COVID experimental vaccines on pregnant women. And, the officials tell us, the vaccine might be needed multiple times, perhaps annually. It's clear that a vaccine is not going to save us. In fact, it has the potential of inflicting enormous suffering on the world's population, not to mention violent resistance to the idea of universal gene modification by electroporation. And all for an illness that is not contagious. Only two things are going to resolve the coronavirus problem. One is a new system of etiquette. Just a few decades ago, few people gave much thought about smoking in someone else's house. Today, such an action is considered the height of rudeness. Today, no one with any sense would light up in front of another person without asking permission, and certainly would not smoke in another person's dwelling place. Today we are shocked to see men and women smoking in old movies. We all know that tobacco companies paid producers to show glamorous people smoking cigarettes, and we shake our heads in disgust. In the future, we will feel the same disgust when we see people in the movies hold cell phones to their ears. How could filmmakers encourage such a dangerous practice? Like the warnings on cigarette packages, there will be warnings on cell phones against use by children. Sales of cell phones to young people will be forbidden. And no one will dream of entering another person's home with their cell phones on. Public pressure will ensure that all large gatherings, sports events, concerts, fairs, conventions, choir practice, dress rehearsals, church services, and private parties, begin with admonitions to turn cell phones to airplane mode. High schools will not allow cell phones on campus, and all computer input for children will be in wires. Offices will designate special areas for cell phone use, in deference to the electrically sensitive, like special areas for smoking, and give all employees old-fashioned telephones. The second task involves a massive cleanup. Just as the Industrial Revolution created unsanitary conditions that took decades of patient hard work, as well as new technologies, to amend, the wireless revolution will require the same patient remediation. Mainly by putting as much communication as possible into wires, but also by exploring new technologies for mitigating EMFs in the home and office. New houses will be built with minimizing EMF exposure in mind, and old houses will be upgraded, just as old houses eventually got bathrooms and central heating. These measures are not as glamorous as introducing a vaccine that will bring fame and fortune to a few, but they are the only real solution to the electro-smog pollution of the internet age. And there is some good news. For years, the telecommunications companies have collected fees from your phone bill in order to bring high-speed fiber optics to every home, school, and business in America, fees amounting to more than $5,000 per household and totaling billions of dollars. But instead of putting fiber optics everywhere, the job is only about 50% complete. These companies invested this money illegally to force people into wireless plans. Accounting tricks have made fiber optics services appear unprofitable while wireless seemed extremely profitable. The telecommunications companies, in collusion with the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, have used these distorted financial results to argue that they cannot bring wired internet to rural areas or even inner cities. More important, these accounting tricks have provided an excuse to shut off the wired networks and go wireless with 5G. Some telecommunications executives have even proposed getting rid of old-fashioned telephone service. Fortunately, a recent court case, JR Regulators v. FCC, DC Court of Appeals opinion, March 13, 2020, removes FCC jurisdiction and returns it to state regulatory agencies. All illegal subsidies for wireless can now be stopped, and 5G is no longer profitable.